Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 432nd episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor. I'm the director of program and practice support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada. I'm also a professor at the University of Alberta.
And so, Mike, this is the third podcast that we're going to do on heart failure. And as we promised in the end of the second one, we're going to talk about how to take all the evidence that we've talked about and put it into practice, about how to think about it. And again, there's nothing magical, but, you know, at the end of that last podcast, I said, well, why don't we just give five drugs and that's the end of it. And you said, well, we could give more.
We could give more. And I remember after after we signed off, you said to me, I wish we'd give more.
Yeah. Exactly. I always do that at highest doses.
Because 8 pills isn't enough.
Yeah, no. So what we're going to do, we're going to take the evidence that we've got. We're going to try and figure out what to start first, maybe some stuff on dosing, what to monitor and how to think about it. But there's no magical answer to this. What we've come to the conclusion is that we have evidence that beta blockers, ACE inhibitors, ARBs, spironolactone, activity, and a variety of other medications, those are the main ones that I just mentioned, reduce mortality and reduce hospitalizations for heart failure. And there are no studies where they add them all together, but there has been what we called a network meta-analysis that gave some insight. And we talked about that, you know, maybe you get the maximum, you don't get the maximum benefit from just two, but boy, once you get to two, maybe three, adding on doesn't necessarily give you a huge amount of benefit. It's a value to be on at least a couple, and we'll talk about that. But, you know, do you really need to go to 7? Or as they say in Spinal Tap, go to 11.
because 11's louder than 10.
Exactly.
So it's very, very tricky because there are so many interventions here. And at the same time, we're getting pressure about polypharmacy, but we're also getting pressure about prescribing. And in some of the trials, patients were already on 2 or 3 therapies as a standard of care. So certainly the dabigatran one, which we mentioned before, that trial, virtually everyone was on some form of ACE or ARB. Almost everyone was on a beta blocker, and 70% or so were on a spironolactone or a eplerenone type drug. So. Yeah, yeah. There are trials where they have been piled on and they do show benefit. But these are patients who are often in trouble despite all of those. Right. So what do you do with your person who you've just discovered has heart failure, or they've just had their first admission for heart failure? What is your first step? And that's a good question.
Yeah, we can talk about class 4 later on, but this is, and almost all the studies are class 2 and class 3.
Right, and so that's you're thinking this is the first time this is really showing up or that kind of thing. So I think, you know, we talk about symptom management, and Lasix is or furosemide is your go-to, and I don't think anyone would argue that that has to be part of the menu of choices.
Oh, yeah, no, for sure.
And again, clarifying, this is the systolic type heart failure with reduced ejection fraction. But I, you know, it's interesting because our go-to, I would say our reflex drug of prevention is probably an ACE/ARB.
Right. But before, I totally agree. But before we get, I think everyone would agree if the patient is relatively symptomatic. I mean, you can have class 2 where the symptoms are pretty mild, right? You know, you may not need to be, you know, titrating and using, furosemide or something like that. But I think the evidence is clear that furosemide is just as good as anything else and probably the least expensive. Yeah. And so, I mean, I think most people at least should have furosemide around as their first treatment.
Yes, that's what I was going to say. Because even if they're not needing it every day, they need to have kind of a 20 milligram dose, like a bottle of that in their house so that when they're weighing themselves and, wow, I gained 3 pounds in the last 2 days.
Yeah, and it wasn't just Thanksgiving.
Yeah. yeah, that may be water. And so,
yeah.
So it's good to have that around, and it would be good because, you know, you phone your doc and I'm not feeling very well and it's towards the end of the day. Well, take a Lasix, stay up and pee for a while, see me tomorrow morning or something like that. And obviously if they're really sick, they need to go into hospital, et cetera, or be seen immediately regardless.
I think it'd be a value to talk a little bit about. So, you know, whenever I see people who have heart failure, often they're just on like 40 of Lasix and there's no, you know, they're just always on it. And I think because this is a relatively speaking symptomatic drug, this is something that you can relatively speaking dose to effect. And I think, you know, just like you said, with the whole concept of weight and all that sort of process, I think we have
swollen ankles, symptoms.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, there's all sorts of ways that they can help monitor their process, but they can, you know, and then there's all the crazy stuff like JVP and our ability to accurately assess that and everything. But aside from all that, when patients are at home, I think that managing this to a small extent by themselves is reasonable. Now, you don't want them, you know, taking a lot of Lasix and not informing you, and all of a sudden, you know, they're sick with hypokalemia.
No, and I think it's go ahead.
But some titration is very reasonable, and I think many of us who've practiced for a little while have had patients who are, let's say, on a day, maybe even on a daily dose, but to have some extra pills for when they or know to take extra pills when they're increasing, and you almost have a, you know, that the old asthma action plan for what it was worth, but you have that for your patients. You know, if you're feeling worse, if you're gaining weight, try this, give me a call, blah blah blah.
Yeah, and just watch out for things like, you know, if you're you know, extremely lightheaded. Now, you're going to be lightheaded with most of the medication they're on, but that's one of the concepts. If you've given too much, and you know, what you want to do is you don't want these people to gain weight. That's the key thing that you're trying to reduce the risk of, and as much as possible titrate it with whatever amount of Lasix. And we could get into a little bit about, you know, is it best to give just a big dose of Lasix every day, or do you give, you know, a dose every, you know, twice a day or whatever? And, you know, I've tried to find any evidence for that one way or the other. And I think, you know, if you had to really, you know, put me into a corner and say, what would you do? I think I'd rather give 20 twice a day than 40 once a day if you want to get more diuretic effect. But the problem with giving it twice a day is, you know, Mike, is, you know, especially if you give it at bedtime, that basically
it's not bedtime anymore.
No, it's not. Yeah. Unless you're sleeping directly on a toilet. So I think it's really important that we have to have that conversation with, here's how you use Lasix. Here's how you think about it. And, you know, sort of help patients figure out how to do that themselves if they're capable of doing that. And then once you've done that, then, you know, now we have to talk about all of the other medications that potentially you would be on, regardless of whether you have symptoms.
Well, and if you're BIDing Lasix, which, and then, so I agree with what you said, you will probably get slightly better diuresis, but when you think about 220s versus 140, you really have to think about comfort and getting all your peeing over with in the morning.
It doesn't necessarily mean right in the morning and just before you go to bed, but you could do it, you know, in the morning and then, you know, at five.
Mid-afternoon.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's another good time. Yeah.
So now the preventative agents, and like we talked about at the beginning, there's lots of them. And so now we have to figure out where to start with them. Like, what do you do? How do you start that? I know if you talk to people who come out of hospital, it's not unusual that they just literally come home on four or five medications.
At least three.
No one knows whether they're tolerating it. No one knows whether they need them all. No one, and I can tell you right now, in all the people I've ever spoken to, none of them even know why they're really on it. You know, they said I was fine.
That should never stop us.
No, I know. I was fine. You know, I was fine, and I had this, and now I'm on. I've never had a drug ever. I've never taken a medication ever. And now I'm on five.
This was the classic diabetes, right?
Yeah.
Hi, you know, in the late 1990s, early 2000s. Hi, you have diabetes. Here's your aspirin. Here's your ACE inhibitor. Mm-hmm. Here's your metformin, and here's your statin. See you next week. We'll start another drug.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, I think that I was going to say this earlier, the kind of knee-jerk reaction, I think, for anybody when you say heart failure and prevention is ACE inhibitor.
Absolutely.
For that matter. But I think it's like, you know, it's almost you could get a parrot because we've been so programmed in it. So, you know, what drug should we give? ACE inhibitor?
Yeah.
Because we all know that that's the one. But as you know, research later on showed that the beta blockers look like they're at least as good, if not maybe slightly better.
Yeah, yeah.
And so,
unfortunately, no head-to-head comparisons, but yeah.
Exactly. No head-to-head. So it's really tough to say, but I think either one of those would be a reasonable first drug. And when I say first drug, it's not that, you know, one drug and leave it alone and let it be. But that you've got to start somewhere, and I prefer not to, unless there's a need to pour medicines on urgently, which often there isn't.
No,
you would start. I would start with an ACE probably.
Yeah,
and or a beta blocker. And when I'm feeling very, very evidence based, I probably start a beta blocker first.
Yeah,
and when I'm feeling like I need to copy what my colleagues do, I start an ACE inhibitor. Yeah. I don't think either thing is wrong.
No.
But that's and I think I'd be interested to see. I've never really noticed if my cardiology colleagues were to start one at a time, would they pick?
For? Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
No, I don't know, usually it's done in a hospital setting, and here's where it gets tricky: is that they go, okay, if we're going to be evidence based, you know, we have sort of metrics that we need to do. We want to make sure we get as many people on an ACE and a beta blocker and all that. And it's part of the, it's almost, you know, so we want to do that right away in case it doesn't happen. But I think, you know, I don't know if that's the right way, but it's certainly the easiest way is you just start a whole bunch at, you know, whatever doses, we'll get to that in a minute. And then hope that people tolerate it. But I think unless it's, and I can't even think of a case where it's an urgent, this is not an urgent, urgent thing. It's something that we're going to be dealing with over certainly a few months, you know? So mm-hmm. I agree with you. Let's say you'd start an ACE inhibitor. I would suggest, do you care which ACE inhibitor?
No, but I don't, but which one have I given the most is Ramipril. So guess which one I'm going to give.
Yeah. Cause you remember the dose of it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's the truth about how we prescribe. We're most likely to prescribe what we prescribed yesterday.
Yeah.
So,
I don't think there's any evidence that one is better than another. And so I would suggest if at all possible that it be based on cost. Now that's not always possible because none of these really need to be given more than once a day. Even there's some older data, I think that you could give Captopril once a day, but most people don't use Captopril anymore. But I think any of the prills, you should go ahead and I would base it on cost initially.
Yeah, if you know the cost and if there's a meaningful difference in cost, exactly. Like certainly, and so many provinces now are going to kind of that reference based pricing, which I think is quite reasonable. Yeah, yeah. And so if your province has that and they've told you which one they've got for the best deal, that's the one you would give. I when I was with the forces, our cost drug was. Oh, I'm drawing a blank on the name of it. Lisinopril.
Yeah.
It was Lisinopril. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
And so that was my drug. And I actually don't think that anyone got worse or care because of that.
No,
it's probably the exact same as all of them.
Yeah.
So whatever is your reference price, if you have that in your province or one of the reasonable ones, I wouldn't give Perendopril. It was when I last checked on patent, although that has to be coming off now. Yeah. And it's not a bad drug. It's just
expensive. No, and so again, just go with the least expensive if you can figure that out, and that's usually a generic version of it, and so on. And then the issue is the most important thing is that we want to. I don't know if you knew this, but we don't want to make people feel worse.
Wait, I'm taking notes.
Yeah, could you take? Yeah, write that down. So is it not why? In hospital,
are you the first person to say that, James?
I am.
First, do no harm. That seems. I think I've heard that before.
Yeah, my middle name begins with H, but I can't remember what that stood for.
Hippopotamus.
Yeah, hippopotamus. So I know in general this doesn't happen, but it just annoys me that it doesn't because there is no way you can figure out whether a person will be able to tolerate big doses of. Well, you and I couldn't tolerate if we got a beta blocker and spironolactone and an ACE inhibitor at, you know, big doses, we'd probably feel pretty crappy too.
Yeah. I mean, these, this is a great example of the whole polypharmacy thing, where we think if we blanket polypharmacy, all being wrong when you're at five or more drugs, then anyone with heart failure is going to be treated wrong, because they're going to end up on a bunch of medicines. Like, and it's not, we said that probably three is, and then Lasix is easily justifiable. Mm-hmm. And then if they've got any other condition at all, like intermittent pain in their knees, they're on what have you. And then all of a sudden, bang, they're on five drugs.
Yeah. Yeah.
So this is the tricky part of this, as you said, and we know that as you pile on drugs, you're just adding, everyone adds a new level of risk for adverse drug events. And not just because it's an individual drug, but because of the combination of products.
Yeah. No.
So I agree. I think we're setting ourselves up, and we have to have a very, like, I try and remember every time someone comes in with a new symptom, especially they're on a number of pills, is to say to myself, is there anything I'm doing that could be causing this symptom
right.
for the patient?
Yeah.
And you know, so if they're having a cough or anything like that, or the dizziness, then you have to really reflect, even if it's just a low dose to start out with of an ACE.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, so you have to have a very low, a high index of suspicion
right.
that your drugs, especially in the cases of ACEs, where we have a relatively good alternative being ARBs.
Yeah, no, exactly. And so, drugs like enalapril and ramipril, when you look at them, the recommended starting dose is twice a day, and then other ones are once a day. And I would just literally start any of these just sort of once a day. And I mean, you could make an argument that maybe it should just be in the evening, you know, especially with some of the hypertension trial stuff coming out, you know, about taking medications in the evening. But I would just start with a low dose, like with enalapril or ramipril, you know, 1.25 milligrams. That's, and just see how they tolerate it. I don't see it started that low very often, but you know, that would be a start, and see how they respond to it over 2 or 3 days, because, well, you know, as well as I know, you know, enalapril and ramipril were used for, you know, hypertensive crises. And so you could give it and blood pressure drops pretty quickly, like within, you know, 30 minutes to an hour if you take it. And so you can see the effect it's going to have on blood pressure pretty quickly. So, you know, there may be a goal to get to some of the higher doses, which we'll talk about in a minute. But I would just start each one of them, you know, with quite a low dose and make sure they tolerate it, because that's, again, getting back to do no harm.
Yeah. And if you're really worried about getting to higher doses, you can titrate up to those with more frequent visits.
Oh,
but we're going to talk about the beauty of higher doses. And when I say more frequent visits, even at the end of the week, I just saw someone this week, and I'm planning to see them at the week again, because we've got to take a close look at something that's changing for them with their blood pressure, et cetera. Yeah. So this is a common thing. We just have to see them a little more regularly for a while.
And I would suggest, you know, if you're going to, I don't think it's that unreasonable to start with both an ACE inhibitor and a beta blocker at the same time. I mean, it goes against all the principles we usually talk about, but I think it's not unreasonable. But again, both of those start with very low doses. And then if you can, over a period of a few weeks, start to build up the doses, as long as they're, you know, they don't have orthostatic hypotension, they're not feeling completely yucky on the medications, and that's a medical term, by the way, yucky. That, you know, there's a scale for it, anywhere from, you know,
yeah, it's in the Merck manual at the back.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I think that would be the approach. Now, that's not typically done, but I think that's probably the best way to do it if you want to make sure they tolerate it and get them at least on. I would suggest at a minimum, if you can get them on an ACE and a beta blocker, you're doing a lot of the work that needs to get done.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. You know, and we're not trying to say that spironolactone, that drug isn't effective. Mm-hmm. It's probably very similarly effective to the other two.
Yeah.
But it has a few more problems with hyperkalemia, et cetera, and so requires some monitoring. So I would put that one third, but not necessarily because it's bad for any specific reason. It just has a few more things you have to worry about. So I leave it for third.
Yeah. And then the question comes, let's just start with those two medications. There is a, you know, you can read a lot of articles and they'll say the target dose of enalapril is 10 BID and ramipril is 5 BID. And it really varies. And we've looked at this evidence in, you know, at length, and the vast majority of drugs literally have no studies. showing, you know, this is the correct target dose. But I think we talked about this on a previous podcast. We did, I think what is at least a complete publication of the data. We did the first meta-analysis of what's the benefit of getting to higher doses of things like ACEs and ARBs and beta blockers. And we published that just a few months ago, if I remember correctly, Mike, back in February of 2019. And we looked at, again, at the two endpoints that were important, hospitalizations for heart failure. And the studies were typically somewhere between, you know, 2 to 4 years. And these studies randomized people to somewhat lower doses and then higher doses. And what we found is that with ACE inhibitors for hospitalization for heart failure, there was no benefit in regards to, there was no difference in hospitalization for heart failure, but there was a difference in heart failure worsening. So about 5% less people had less heart failure worsening. And what's important to, and I forgot to mention this, overall, there is no difference in mortality. So mortality is not impacted by getting people to higher doses. It's purely to do with potentially symptoms, I think. I think you'd agree with that, eh, Mike?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think, you know, so if you look at the endpoints of hospitalization for heart failure, no difference for ACEs, but heart failure worsening, it was about 5% less. For ARBs, hospitalization for heart failure was about 3% less, and these are all absolute numbers. And for heart failing worsening, it was about 3% less. So you are getting and I would suggest this is a relatively small percentage of people benefiting from getting to higher doses. If you can get them to them, great. But we're not talking about that this is a, you know, an absolute must to get them there, despite, you know, being very symptomatic from low blood pressure and so on. And interestingly, you know, even with beta blockers, even though there's many charts that recommend that these are the doses that you need to titrate them to do, we couldn't find any evidence that it did anything to any important outcome.
And later on, it's unlikely you'll make it home today because someone is going to hunt you down and get rid of you for this blasphemy.
Exactly. But there was just no studies to guide. There's some sort of, you know, markers where they've looked at, you know, that they looked at blood pressure differences and they looked at heart rate differences and so on. But we looked at all of the studies and the studies of beta blockers did not show a difference. We couldn't show a difference when we put all the trials together. What was fairly consistent is that we saw.
Hang on, James. You didn't mention the outcome of importance. Did microalbuminuria change?
Oh, absolutely, it did. Yeah, but no one noticed it because no one cared.
That's wrong. I bet you there are lots of people who care, but they shouldn't.
Yeah, but go but ahead. So there clearly is evidence of an improvement in at least heart failure worsening when you get to higher doses, but we're talking maybe 3 to 5% benefit over a 2 to 4 year period. But the concern is they do on average get more side effects, and we see more hypotension, dizziness, hyperkalemia, and increased serum creatinine when we use higher doses of ACEs and ARBs. And the numbers that we're talking about, again, they're not huge numbers, but you get anywhere from sort of like 3 to 5 or 6% more people getting important hypotension, dizziness, and so on. And with the beta blockers, about 14% more people get dizziness if you try to get them to higher doses, which is unfortunate because we have no studies showing that you benefit at all by getting to higher doses. So that's the best available evidence. And we've talked about this before, and it's obviously in the show notes that we've got there. So I would suggest that if you can get to the doses that are being recommended in many guidelines, great. But even in these clinical trials, Mike, we found that, you know, sometimes only a third could even get to these doses, and that's in a clinical trial. So you can imagine what it would be like not in a clinical trial.
Now, I should clarify that when you say we, I wasn't involved in the study. When you brought it up, I said, well, James, I like research. And you said, yeah, but I don't like you.
No, exactly. That's true. That is true.
That may be somewhat how it went at all.
Yeah, yeah.
But you've actually compiled the list from the CCS indicating what the target doses are for the different medications.
Yeah.
So we should at least mention some of them and which ones have even been researched.
Yeah, no, exactly. And so the Canadian Cardiovascular Society heart failure dose recommendations, they give, you know, starting doses and target doses for our ACEs and ARBs and beta blockers and mineralocorticoids and the ARNIs, the sacubitril, the valsartan ones. And so when I was looking at this, I went, well, how do they do that? Because I know for a fact that there are no studies for the vast majority of these drugs. So I know for a fact there's not a single study for mineralocorticoids. There's no dose response studies for ARNIs. There's no dose response studies for vasodilators. Now, there is one for beta blockers. So there's nothing for bisoprolol. There's nothing for metoprolol. There is a study for carbetolol. When it comes to the ARBs, there's no study of valsartan, but there is one for candesartan. And for the ACE inhibitors, there's only two studies, and one was with enalapril and one was lisinopril. So perindopril, ramipril, and trandolapril don't have studies showing, looking at starting doses versus getting to target doses. So all these numbers have been extrapolated from the relatively small number of trials that have been looked at. And even when you look at the Canadian Cardiovascular Society dose recommendations, the target doses they're recommending actually aren't taken from the studies that they use to support them, which drives me a bit crazy. Nonetheless, the numbers are...
Never let that stop.
No, never let that. So the numbers that they're giving are not completely unreasonable, but I just want people to be aware that that's the tricky evidence piece that we're trying to deal with. So, you know, when you're looking at enalapril, if you can get them to 10 milligrams BID, and then they say 20 milligrams BID in New York Heart Class 4, and lisinopril, if you can get them to 20 or 35 milligrams daily, and so on. So those are the sort of doses we're talking about. But if all they can tolerate is the lowest dose, then you leave them on it. If you can get them to twice that, you leave, and they can't get any, they don't tolerate doses higher than that, then you don't go any higher. So I think it's a very conservative, slow approach. And if you can get them there, great. But Mike, I don't know what your experience has been in practice, but even like I said, in most clinical trials, they can't get them to them. So it's really important that we don't overemphasize or oversell the fact that it's that important.
Well, the whole word target is oversold, right?
Yeah,
it's exactly. Oversold for hitting targets. It's oversold for target doses. Mm-hmm. Everything, and much of it is based on extrapolation or hope in a belief system. And so it's not, and yet we know, you know, in the pharmacodynamics, and here you, James, this is your chance to jump in, yeah. That the majority of the effect occurs at the lowest dose.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so the benefit, but the harms occur at the highest doses. So you're just playing against the odds as you go higher. It's not that it's completely unreasonable. It's possible it could benefit someone, and that someone could be the person in front of you. But at the cost of harms, it's not a reasonable exchange.
No, exactly. So if they're not tolerating them, you really should be questioning whether you want to push it any higher.
And back off, if anything.
Oh, yeah,
right?
Because, and back off. But what you don't want to do is, because, you know, I'm sure you probably talk to patients who just feel wretched on them, and they just stop them.
Exactly.
And that's not what we want them to do. But we, you know, I think it's legitimate to let people know, you know what, over the first week or two, you may feel a little bit lightheaded until you get accustomed, until your body sort of, you know,
adapts
to it all. So we got to explain really well why we're starting and what to look for, and say, look, over the first week or two, we're going to try to get you to higher doses if we can, but that's our goal, is to not have you have symptoms. But the medications are of enough value that let's see if we can get you to at least some dose of them, and then we'll deal with the rest of it later. I think that's, you know, probably the best way. Again, whenever I've seen this done in hospital, it's not done that way at all.
Yeah, no, it's just, well, and even this whole thing about starting doses and then target doses, it's generally, hi, how are you doing? Here's 10 milligrams of ramipril.
Yeah.
In the hospital, like once you get admitted, they generally just pour them on often at the same time at the max dose or the preferred dose for that doc. So,
and then they never see, and the patient completely tolerates it because they're lying in a bed.
Yeah. And monitored all the time.
Yeah,
and then
exactly.
They go home and 3 weeks later,
and they go, I don't understand why I have no blood pressure. and it makes me a little dizzy. Yeah. So we got the ACE inhibitors. The least expensive, start with low doses. Now, beta blockers. Now, if you were being very, very evidence-based, Mike, I think you would agree that, you would sort of have to choose carvedilol over metoprolol. But we talked about this trial previously, the COMET trial. There are some reasonable criticisms of that study to suggest that, that it's not clear that carvedilol is clearly superior to metoprolol. Now, I think if they were relatively the same price, I would probably go with carvedilol. But, sure. I think you likely need to be on a beta blocker. And again, I'd probably go with the least expensive. I don't know if that's what you would do.
That is what I do. Yeah.
Yeah. So, that's sort of, sort of the best approach. So those are the two medications. Now, where it becomes not tricky, I think people would be fairly comfortable to say that if you are in class 3 to 4 heart failure, that now you do need to consider, adding in some sort of a mineralocorticoid agent, because the magnitude of the benefit with those is fairly impressive, at least compared to what we do with many other medications.
Absolutely. And you can also start then to think about, and so what might be your trigger? Well, worsening of symptoms is clearly one, but an admission, I would say, once they come out with a recent admission, then you would consider adding that second one, the third one.
Unless you could identify that they just, they weren't paying attention.
Oh, there was something, yeah.
To their furosemide dosing or whatever. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, for sure. Like they ran out of it. We can always come up with reasons, though, so you have to be careful.
Yeah.
That you're not overcalling the reason.
Yeah.
And they're really trying to cover up for a real a just gradual worsening, which is what is to be expected.
Yeah.
The other thing you can do too is think about the drug sacubitril, and then what you would do is stop whatever ACE you're using and switch them to the combination product with, I think you've abbreviated them, ARNIs.
Yeah.
That's another option.
So where it gets a little bit tricky is when you look at the cost of these medications. So,
that one's crazy.
Yeah, it's $250 a month. That's more than...
That's the killer.
Yeah, that's more than all the other drugs added together in total times three.
Yeah, so it would be, when we're thinking about cost, that would be definitely after spironolactone, and if they had coverage would be a key issue.
Yeah.
It's interesting to me that I was giving a talk somewhere in the U.S. and someone came up to me and said they were a rep for that product, and they were very disappointed that docs hadn't been jumping on board with it as quickly as they hoped, because their clinical trial was relatively good. The reminder is the $250 price is here in Canada. In the US it's going to be considerably higher than that. So it's a lot of patients just can't afford that.
So
It's an issue. But yeah, the spironolactone is cheap.
Yeah, it's about, $5 a month. And I mean, it depends whether you add all of the different fees and so on, but it's roughly speaking $5 a month. And the eplerenone is about $75 a month. And I don't know if there's no evidence that I'm aware of that it's worth $75 a month versus $5 a month to use something like eplerenone.
The only advocacy for eplerenone over spironolactone, I think, is the potential reduction in gynecomastia.
Exactly.
That's the only thing I'm aware of. It's a tiny difference anyway, but there is a difference there in a few
and
studies.
If you gave spironolactone and the patient got some breast tenderness that is clearly uncomfortable, you may want to switch from spironolactone. But I still think, starting with low doses of spironolactone would be the approach to go in these class 3-4 heart failure patients. And one of the nice things about spironolactone, and same with the ACE inhibitors, though, is that they're very efficient at maintaining potassium. So if you have a patient on lots of diuretics, you can help maintain their potassium. You may maintain it too high.
Exactly. I was going to say that's one of the problems with spironolactone.
Especially if you add it to an ACE inhibitor.
It is a problem. And in fact, there was a editorial after the spironolactone study that reminded docs about the importance of monitoring for hyperkalemia with them, because the title of the title of the editorial was "The First Sign of Hyperkalemia is Death."
Yeah,
and it's just a good reminder that you can't really. There can be symptoms for it, but they can also be without symptoms until the person arrests. So yeah, no, exactly. It was just a good reminder for us of the needs. You can't just start that drug without doing some monitoring, unfortunately.
So speaking of monitoring, so let me ask you. So when you're speaking to a patient, what do you think the key messages are that you need to tell them? What should they be monitoring? Because they're not going to monitor their potassium. But what would you be telling them?
Oh, so it's things like... For their heart failure, it's things like weight that we've already talked about.
Yeah.
It's their breathing, their ability to do activities like climbing stairs, or depending, some of them can't do that, but getting around their house, general activities in their home like vacuum cleaning or going out to do shopping if they're finding those difficult, the swelling of the ankles, sometimes swelling of hands, all of these kind of things you tell them to monitor. And I personally have them say to phone in and tell me about it. I've worked in situations where I have nurses who can answer those calls and kind of triage. But I've also, even where I work now, they can come in and see us urgently, or the emergency here, because it's a small town, is much more accessible than than is typical in a lot of places. So there's a lot of options, and I think that patients should. These kind of patients, because it's such a severe condition that leads to hospitalization and deterioration, the leading up to it can be, you know, the analogy is often like a cliff. So you can't tell when you're there until you're falling.
Right.
And so if they're getting symptoms, they should feel free about calling to ask.
Yeah. And by that, you mean sort of worsening of symptoms.
Yeah.
Because they may, I don't think we can tell them that we're going to get rid of all their symptoms, although you can do a pretty good job in some cases, but... And when it comes to sort of measuring weight, I would never ever recommend anybody weighing themselves daily, other than maybe in this case, or at least every couple of days. You know,
would be it.
You know, this is the only population. And then, you know, do you sort of have a threshold? I mean, if they gained, you know, more than 3 or 4 pounds over a period of 3 or 4 days, that would make me nervous.
Yeah, that's kind of it. You don't. It's everyone's different, and because weight is so variable. A bowel movement can change it by a pound or so, and getting up in the...
Boy,
so the
you must have impressive 20. Bowel movements, Mike.
It's not simply personal experience, James. Thank you for... but you know, you try and get them to do it first thing in the morning, because that's the most reliable, predictable weight. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and don't get them to say that, you know, that even, you know, scales have a plus minus in them. So, you know... A pound or two here is not. But when you know, if you're getting a consistent increase of a you know half to a pound a day over a number of days, then that's of concern.
Yes, especially sure. especially
with symptoms.
And then if you can dose them with a little bit of Lasix, and that weight drops off, that's very reassuring.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah. So there's that, and then so on top of just the symptoms that they do and the weight and so on, what other things? I mean, obviously potassium should be done.
Yeah, so we check potassium. You know what? I take the key lights, which is potassium and sodium, and then with creatinine, which now gets converted in, I think most jurisdictions now gets automatically converted to a GFR for you, which is helpful. And then on occasion, I will throw other lights in if I'm suspicious of symptoms of muscle aches and all of those things like calcium and everything. But the majority are... potassium and sodium, because of the different drugs that they're often on, it's not unusual for them to be on a thiazide as well. And so it's good to get a sense for where they are. But the potassium is the most dangerous one. And then, of course, a drop in GFR is very concerning for these patients.
Yeah, and it's actually not unusual. Like, even though we hear that ACE inhibitors are renal protective, it's not unusual when you put a person on an ACE inhibitor for their renal function to not go completely in the toilet, but get
worse. I've had patients who a rare patient that will have a very bad reaction to an ACE inhibitor. And then there's a reasonable chunk that are going to, you know, have a 10-point increase or 5-point increase in their creatinine due to that, due to those drugs. Right. So,
and it's pure, it's not an inherent toxicity of it. It's actually almost always a volume issue.
Yeah,
a blood pressure volume issue.
I watch for it in my patients and keep an eye on it. And in my experience, when their creatinine is going down, they're also their creatinine's going up and their GFR is going down, they're also going to have heart failure troubles.
Right.
And so it's another way to kind of keep an eye on things, recognizing that GFR has a lot and creatinine has a huge variability around it. So, you know, a 5 to 10 point change, unless it's recorded consistently, it's really hard to tell.
I would ignore it. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that in my experience, when you're monitoring these kind of things, if you're lucky enough to have an electronic medical record that graphs these out for you, that can be very helpful because it's almost like an ECG. It's constantly wiggling. Mm-hmm. But if it's wiggling in a downward trend, that's very helpful for you to kind of sort out, okay, I'm not going crazy. This is headed south.
Yeah.
And that's more of a general picture over time.
Yeah, yeah, no, for sure. So potassium, certainly it would be very helpful to have a baseline. And then I would say, you know, at least, you know, in the first 2 to 4 weeks, I'd get another one if you're starting them on ACE inhibitors, and especially if you're doing both ACE inhibitors and spironolactone.
For sure.
Yeah.
For sure. Two weeks. And depends on where they are. If you've got them on an ACE and they're already at above a 5 potassium and you want to start spironolactone, I might be testing them in a week or less.
Yeah. So it just makes you a bit nervous when you do that, because these drugs really do maintain potassium.
Yeah. And so it's back to, I think, your quote, James H. McCormick.
Yes, exactly. Do no harm.
First, do no harm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we've talked about, you know, which drugs to start. It's all about starting with low doses, the least expensive, maybe one at a time, but you could make an argument maybe to start with a couple of times in the class two or three, but they got to make sure they tolerate it. So you need a good conversation with your patients. And then the issue is then are you on them for life? And I think the answer is pretty much for sure. And, you know, because there haven't been a lot of studies of, you know, withdrawal of medications in heart failure. There was one recently published in Lancet in 2019 where they looked at heart failure in patients with this is not the most typical type of heart failure, but people with recovered dilated cardiomyopathy. And they took about 50 patients who were on, you know, ACEs and ARBs and tried to get them off of these medications once they had no symptoms. And a number of people did not worsen, but a number did. About 44% got in a relapse when they looked at things like left ventricular ejection fraction and so on. I am unaware of any sort of, other than with the Lasix and stuff, if you stop those medications, people do get worse. So I think once you're on them, as long as you're tolerating them, I pretty much say that you're on them for quite a long time.
Yes. Yeah. No, they're generally forever.
Yeah. And, you know, you can adjust the dose, relatively speaking, based on symptom controls and so on. So, and then do you ever do any of naturopathic peptide blood testing and all that sort of stuff, you know, for up titration for symptoms and blah, blah, blah.
So it's interesting. I never really got comfortable with that. It wasn't available in my previous province and I haven't used it much here yet in BC. So I'm not not in my wheelhouse because I come from an older generation didn't have it. And it wasn't available to family docs in Alberta.
Yeah, because there is a systematic review published last year on using this to guide up titration of medications compared to symptom guided up titration, and there's 14 RCTs, and there's a suggestion that hospital admissions and mortality are reduced to somewhat, you know, maybe in the sort of 15 to 20% range, but the evidence, they said, the quality ranged from low to very low. So it's really tricky. I think the most important thing is to just do it based on symptoms and leave these other sort of monitoring things to people who think they really think they know how to do them. But in general, yeah. I think it's a symptom-based sort of approach. I think you'd agree, right?
Yeah, but I will say that don't base it on me just because I haven't had the exposure, no. right? So there's lots of docs, family docs around that I think use it and use it well. We had a patient a couple months ago that I asked one of my colleagues about and got some advice on what to do for this patient, but it's just because I haven't had the exposure in the front lines in my clinic because I only moved to BC where we can do it about a year ago. So
we'll just run down just some final thoughts on the whole process that we've gone through over the last few podcasts. So most classes of medications reduce mortality around 15 to 20%. Heart failure hospitalizations are reduced by about 25 to 35%, and those are all relative numbers. We believe that most of the benefits are additive, but as we talked about even in this podcast, but once you're on a couple of agents, there's somewhat limited additional benefit, except maybe if you get to sort of the class 4 patient population. When you get to class 4, now we're talking about adding spironolactone because the evidence is pretty clear for that. I would suggest that really adverse effects from these medications are as much as possible unacceptable. Because even just one medication, you know, it's not like 100% of people get a benefit from these medications. So we've talked about that they should be on these medications if you can get them there because they're basically preventative ones. But I don't think we need to tolerate adverse events with these medications. And to reduce the chance of that, starting with low doses, maybe start one at a time and titrate based on tolerability. And I think you'd probably agree, Mike, that if you could, it'd be better to be on low doses of 2 or 3 than trying to get just big doses of 1.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the evidence would support that as well,
exactly. I think. I think we do need to take into account cost, or at least the cost that we have here in Canada, diuretics and spironolactone, about $5 a month, ACEs and ARBs and beta blockers, somewhere around $10 to $15 a month. And then, you know, the newer drugs, ivabradine and eplerenone are $75 a month, and the sacubitril and valsartan combination is $250 a month. So those all come into the play with a whole process. So yeah. I think as much as possible, we've wrapped this one up in a nice, tidy little package, or not.
Any closing words on the Starling curve, James?
Yes, there is one. And and Mike, if you look out your window right now, do you see any starlings?
No, they're introduced species here, James.
That doesn't mean they may be there. You just go look, because that's Mike's.
but they're not woodland birds. So no. There you go.
Yeah. See, I have no idea.
And I'm in the woods.
I have no idea that that's true. But I'll take your word for it. And just to let people know, our next
I see an ostrich.
An ostrich, really? Nice. Yes. Yeah, those are indigenous, aren't they? To
yes, for sure. To where you Salt live. Spring Island.
To Salt Spring Island, yeah. So I think we'll leave it at that. It's quite a long podcast, but hopefully you guys got some useful tips and suggestions out of it. This is, you probably noticed that when it comes to heart failure, there's a lot of evidence, but boy, is there a lot of art to this whole process. And that's kind of our job, is to put the art to the evidence. And hopefully that was go ahead.
I will say one other thing, because a lot of people talk about evidence-based people being evidence nihilists and that kind of thing, that we're nihilists for treatment. I think heart failure, and I might have mentioned this before, is just one of the areas where we have a relatively good evidence base, mm-hmm. and certainly a really good evidence base compared to a lot of things we do. And the interventions do have an impact on patient-oriented outcomes. Yeah. And so, especially as patients get sicker, just like we know with AFib, they get more benefit the sicker they are, and with statins, et cetera. Well, heart failure is a dangerous condition, as we outlined earlier, and so the benefits are there. And it's just a good reminder that that evidence doesn't always say things don't work. There's a lot of things that work here, and they work in a preventative framework. They work relatively well.
No, exactly. So I don't think there's anything we need to really sell today, other than we do have a course coming up in the last couple of weeks of April, I think 23, 24, 24, 25, I can't remember, next year. So we're just finalizing the course for that. And I think we'll leave it at that. So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.